Now tonight we're going to deal with three things, really. We're going to talk about the unique character of the biblical philosophy of history. We're going to characterize the biblical philosophy of history as compared with the conceptions of history which existed in the ancient world prior to and at the same time that the biblical philosophy of history was developing. This will give us a clear idea as to what we mean when we talk about a biblical conception of history, since we'll be comparing other views with it in the course. And then we're going to go on to say something about two of the most influential secular philosophies of history in competition with the Christian worldview. These are the philosophies of history of Hegel and Marx. And next time, we will continue with two other secular conceptions of history subsequent to Hegel and Marx, namely Spengler and Toynbee. And we expect that you will see a film next time in connection with the lecture. This is a film discussion between Arnold Toynbee and a teaching assistant at Harvard. And in this film discussion, Toynbee presents his philosophy of history along with desultory information, which certainly will amuse you, such as information on his Uncle Harry, on his mother, etc., etc. This will give you an opportunity to see a bit of Toynbee, his personality, and also to hear a brief explanation of his philosophy of history as he himself presents it. Then following that session, we will talk about some contemporary theologies of history, how some contemporary theologians have understood history. And then in our final sessions, we will deal with those crux issues of Christian philosophy of history, namely the historicity of Jesus, the question of the miraculous, and the way in which these bear on the interpretation of historical events. So tonight, first of all, we want to say something about the unique character of the biblical philosophy of history. Let me say at the very beginning that we are not here attempting to demonstrate that the Christian philosophy of history is correct, merely to show that the Christian philosophy of history has unique characteristics. Does not, of course, say that this is necessarily correct. On the other hand, if the Christian philosophy of history were simply to be a potpourri of other conceptions, a kind of mélange, a mixture of other views, a kind of half-baked representation of other positions, this would probably say something negatively about it. It's important to be very clear as to what we mean by the Christian philosophy of history in order to see what we are endeavoring later on in the course to validate. And it's essential that we have a clear understanding of what we mean by the biblical picture of history, so that we don't get this confused with competing options. And some of these competing options claim in some sense to be Christian. For example, Hegel frequently used Christian terminology and thought that in some sense he was doing a theology of history. Well, in some sense he was, but we'll soon see that it was not the Christian philosophy of history. The most remarkable thing about the biblical philosophy of history is its radically different character as compared with the attitude toward history that one finds elsewhere in the ancient world, and indeed now outside of the Judeo-Christian tradition. If you go back into the dim recesses of the past, you find that in general, people are not particularly interested in history. If, for example, you go to the Eastern cultures in which Hinduism and Buddhism, the tantristic faiths, have developed, you find that there is an amazing indifference to historical events. Sometimes people who have grown up in the West get into religious discussion with people who are influenced by the Eastern religions, and these Westerners ask questions such as, well, how do you know that the Buddha lived at the time he did? How do you know that he actually said what he did? And so on. And they are nonplussed to find that the advocates of the Eastern religions are largely indifferent to such questions. Their attitude is, we are presenting an experiential way of looking at the universe, and whether the material on the Buddha is historically sound or not is of little importance. The significant thing is simply that this way is provided, and if you want to go along with it, go ahead, and you will see the value of it for your own life. The significance of the Eightfold Path in Buddhism does not depend in any sense upon certain historical events having happened. In fact, the Eastern religions are remarkably similar to what in the West has been called philosophical monism. That is, the notion that the entire universe is a unity, and that God is a name that can be given to everything that is. And the religious task is, in the final analysis, to tune in on this reality in which one finds oneself living already. Prior to the introduction of Christianity into the Indian culture, there was very little interest in rectifying social evils. For example, the caste system. Gandhi himself, who was not a Christian, admitted that it was Christian influence in general, and on him in particular, that it had the greatest single impact in getting the caste system dealt with. Now, why was the Indian culture indifferent to a question such as that of the caste system? Well, historical events in time, simply didn't have enough significance. Each person came into the world carrying a load of karma, and this load of karma or evil had been carried from a previous transmigration, and one in this life, in the present life, could either increase this or decrease it. The round of existences would continue until such time as a person is able to remove his desire to separate himself from contact with the world so that he is able to disappear from existence. The goal, the tantristic goal, is to pass out of the round of historical existences and enter the realm of nirvana. Nirvana is variously characterized. It's sometimes described in terms that make it seem a little bit like the Western heaven, but really a better conception, more in line with Eastern philosophy, is that in nirvana one loses one's individual existence and one passes back into this vast unity which is existence. Analogies, allegories, metaphors are used of this. As the drop of rainwater passes back into the ocean from which it came, so we pass back into Brahma. Under this kind of a world view, the problem of a caste system or the difficulties of society pale in significance. What's the point of trying to get involved in the amelioration of social ills when it's exactly that kind of involvement that keeps you in the round of existences? You see, it isn't just doing evil that keeps you in this round of reincarnation. It's doing anything or involving yourself or committing yourself in any fashion. Thus, the ideal is not to analyze history or even to participate in it. The ideal is to remove your desire from the historical drama. And in doing this, it may be possible for you to move out of the round of existences back into the totality of being. This means that in the Eastern frame of reference, there is relatively little interest in history as such. This is also true if you go farther east into Chinese or Japanese culture. Now, in Chinese culture, the Sinic culture that Toynbee talks about, there is a great deal of interest in the family. And there is some work done genealogically in antiquity because of interest in the family. But this is quite different from an interest in history as such. The contact with the ancestor is a kind of familial worship which ties one to one's past, one's personal past, but there isn't an interest in the past as such. And indeed, the major religious position which develops in the Chinese culture is that of Confucius, which is essentially a present-directed morality. This is not a religion which ties directly with past experience. Relatively little effort is made in this kind of a context to discover what history means. Now, when we go to the Near East, with the exception of the Hebrew tradition, we find something very much like this. We find, for example, in Egypt or in the Babylonian culture that theophanies are presented. That is, God is identified with the temporal ruler, in some sense of the word, so that eternity and time are blended right in the present. Think of the Pharaoh. The Pharaoh is regarded as a god. In fact, he is regarded as the god, the sun god or the highest deity, and therefore his present existence is a sufficient tie with ultimate reality. It becomes important to have king lists, of course, but it does not become important to have historical narratives. And most of the material that we have coming from ancient Egypt or from the Babylonian or Assyrian cultures consists of chronicle, minimal interpretation, simply lists of sovereigns. In fact, most of the historical data that we have concerning these civilizations arises not from any prepared historical narratives that they wrote. Instead, it comes from the artifacts, the archaeological diggings that have gone on. And much of the material that we have is what we would consider to be ephemeral material, material not intended for historical preservation at all. Normally, the Greeks are considered to be the fathers of Western history. But it's very important to recognize what kind of a conception of history the Greeks held. And this conception of history was carried over by the Romans as well. You know that the Romans were great administrators, great military leaders, but were not particularly original thinkers. Someone has said that when Rome conquered Greece, really Greece conquered Rome. Because it was Greek ideas that transferred to the Roman setting. What was the conception of history that the Greeks held? Well, the Greeks insisted on asking ultimate questions about all aspects of life. You know Socrates' little aphorism, the unexamined life is not worth living. And the Greeks operated with this fundamental principle that no aspect of life deserved to stand without any kind of analysis. Thus, the Greeks were not indifferent to history, as were people in the East. But what kind of an interpretation of history did the Greeks arrive at? The essential idea that the Greeks employed for making history meaningful, for comprehending it, was the idea of the cycle. The Greek conception of history is a cyclical conception. Putting it in popular terms, and this expression still exists with us, history repeats itself. Now, what exactly did the Greeks mean by this? This is difficult to say, because this conception varies between serious historical interpretation and myth. Sometimes it was said that Socrates would drink the hemlock again, Troy would fall again. Now, it's hard to say that people were actually thinking of this in literal historical terms, but they felt that the meaning that could be found in history is a revolving, cycle-like kind of pattern. Why did they come to this? Well, remember that the Greeks claimed no revelation from outside of history that would give them the meaning of it. The Greeks operated from within history themselves. In other words, the Greeks did not claim to have any perspective on the human drama that would go beyond one's ordinary stance in history. All right, think of yourself for a moment in exactly that position. Nobody from the outside has entered history to tell you what it means. No voice of deity has spoken to tell you what history involves and where it's going. You are left to your own observation to determine what it means. Well, the Greeks observed nature and they observed human life. And from these, they developed the cyclical analogy. Now think of nature. Even the most primitive people wake up to the fact that there are ordinary regularities in the movement of heavenly bodies. The moon goes through a cyclical pattern, the position of the planets, and so forth. Here on Earth, the seasons succeed each other again and again. Spring and summer and autumn and winter. And human life seems to go through a cyclical pattern also. People are born and they mature, they get older, they die, and there is the overlapping of the generations. In order to find some meaning in the tremendous variety of historical data, the Greeks imposed on these data, or felt that they were discovering in relation to these data, similar cyclical patterns. In other words, as the heavens manifested cycles, and as individual human life manifested cycles, so corporate human life would operate in that same way. This was the way in which the Greeks found a meaning in history. Now, the biblical approach to this kind of thing is very, very different. It is remarkably different, but it doesn't seem very different, it doesn't seem very peculiar to us today. It certainly doesn't seem unique. And the reason is that the biblical view of history has informed Western civilization. Western civilization has picked up this basic biblical worldview in regard to the nature of history, and that has now pretty well spread throughout the globe. People in the Indian cultures, people in the Sinic cultures, find themselves operating with this same conception, having acquired this from Western influence. And what is this view? Well, it's the view which we've called in the book a linear view. A linear view. Instead of a cyclical pattern of history repeating itself, this is a linear notion of history moving in a definite direction and toward a goal. In the biblical view, history begins at a point, moves in an unrepeatable fashion, and finally terminates at a point. The point at which it begins is creation, if we're talking about cosmic history, or the creation of man, if we're talking about human history, and the timeline continues to the point of the final judgment. Now, this doesn't seem the least bit strange to anybody. These days, the expressions creation and judgment are not as familiar as they were at one time, but the notion of time moving in a linear fashion toward a goal, the notion of progress as such, is a notion which derives from the biblical worldview. I've quoted George P. Grant, a Canadian philosopher who's not a Christian, who says, quite rightly, and he is following and influencing many other people who are authorities in the same area, that the very idea of progress is rooted in the biblical worldview. This is where it came from. Now, in modern times, this notion of progress toward a goal has been secularized. In other words, the goal here at the end, the final point, is interpreted in many different ways. But the fundamental concept as such derives from the biblical material. This notion of history beginning at a point and moving on in a linear fashion, an unrepeatable fashion, on toward an ultimate termination is unique to the biblical conception of history. Now, I've described this in the most basic terms here. It's possible to go into a good deal more detail on this. For example, in the Old Testament, a fundamental historical event is predicted. And much of Old Testament prophecy, much of the content of the Old Testament is directed toward this event. And this event is the coming of Messiah. It's very difficult in the Old Testament to tell exactly where that event occurs along the timeline. And it seems in certain instances that the coming of Messiah is identical with the final judgment. In other words, the coming of Messiah terminates this timeline. However, there are other statements about Messiah that give you the impression that he is a humble servant who suffers for others, and therefore that this coming precedes the final judgment, where there is clear indication that Messiah comes in glory. When we come to the New Testament, the coming of Messiah is set out as occurring in Jesus Christ, and that is set forth as the focal event of history and is identified as a first coming, such that Messiah comes again in judgment at the end of time. Thus, these prophecies in the Old Testament are distributed, if you will, between a first coming, where Messiah comes as a substitute for the sins of mankind, and then at the end of time, he comes in judgment. We look at these prophecies today and we say, gee, that's perfectly obvious, but of course this is just an indication that hindsight is a great deal more effective than foresight. And this is not a bad point to keep in mind in case you have tendencies toward calculating the time of the last judgment. If you have a Millerite kind of mentality, such that you have a tendency to go up on the roof with all of your belongings and sit there waiting for the end, it might not be a bad idea to recognize how very difficult it was to engage in precise predictions as to the first coming of Messiah. Under those circumstances, maybe you ought to take it easy, stay downstairs, and spend your time in more profitable activity. When we introduce the New Testament into this, we find that the total conception of biblical history is linear but centered, or linear and centered. In other words, there is a timeline, there is progress that takes place, and there is a central focus for this. Now, what's so peculiar about this? Why is it that other peoples didn't get this notion? And why is it that the Israelites did? Well, the Israelites claim that they did not work this thing up by clever historiography. They tell us that this conception of history was revealed to them from outside of history. That is, that the God of history entered into it directly and by way of his prophets and his ministers, and presented this view. Now you say, well, that's very interesting. Obviously they wanted to give as much force to this as possible, so that was the explanation that they provided. Well, let's not psychoanalyze them too quickly. The fact of the matter is that this kind of a conception is a very difficult conception to derive if you are operating within history and have no information coming from the outside. Now think of your own experience for a moment. What have you ever had contact with that starts out of nothing? What have you ever had contact with that absolutely and finally and in every sense ends? Answer, nothing, man. Nothing. Everything that you know of relates to something that comes before it. Now you say, but I'm unique. Well, yes, that's right, but even an elementary course in biology will indicate that you did have some forerunners, you know, that you didn't just appear out of the blue. There were, as a matter of fact, some earlier connections involved. And if you talk about your death, yes, you die, you end at this point, but the biologist will point out that the stuff that made you up will remain in the world system and will certainly be available for other uses after that point. In other words, within our human experience, in the words of The Sound of Music, nothing comes from nothing. There has to be some kind of prior material, if you will. And everything continues. Now, in terms of that, a cyclical view of history is far more in line with ordinary human experience. It's quite easy to see how the Greeks would have looked at things that way. What under the sun gave these Israelites the idea that the whole shebang actually began out of nothing, created out of nothing, and would finally come to an end? In presenting Christianity to the Greeks, this was one of the most difficult elements for the Greek to swallow. The notion of creation out of nothing was to a Greek utterly irrational because there were no analogies for it. And indeed, some mediating early Christian fathers handled the problem like this. Creatio ex nihilo, this means in Latin, creation out of nothing, which is a basic affirmation of the biblical religion. And they said, well, let's look at this carefully. This was actually a creation out of nihil. In other words, you've got a bucket full of nihil, you see, and out of this bucket of nihil, the world was made. Now, of course, this in no way solved the problem. It's like the Indian analogy about the world sitting on the back of an elephant and the elephant sitting on the back of a tortoise. You're still left with the question as to what the tortoise is doing there. This simply illustrates the fact that the idea of things starting from zero was so foreign to people's thinking that it was very difficult to convince people outside of the biblical tradition that this sort of thing was the case. Really, it's easiest to understand a view like this if one hypothesizes that there is somebody who stands outside of the whole shebang and who is able to see it in perspective. Naturally, if there were a God who had brought it into existence and who knew perfectly well that he was going to terminate it at a particular point, he could very well reveal this. But just how does such a view arise from within? Well, you can say by extension, by alteration of analogy, etc., etc., and no one is denying that that's possible. But it is very peculiar that the only people who got this idea were people who said, we didn't have any idea like this at all. Lo and behold, he told us it was this way. The one who actually started the show and the one who is going to ring down the curtain. We will discover very shortly that most of the modern views of history are bastardizations of this. Or putting it more attractively, perhaps, they are secularizations of this. That is, the notion of progress is taken over from this. God is conveniently pushed out of the picture. theological terminology is eliminated, and other goals are set. The problem is, and this is the fundamental philosophical problem with all such secularizations of this view, just exactly how do you sustain them? What gives you the idea that things are going to come out to the particular goal that you hold as a secularist? We'll see later on in this period that Hegel's goal of ultimate freedom cannot be supported. Marx's goal of a classless society does not follow logically from the current state of things. The fact of the matter is that the secularist who redoes this thing, redoes it from within history, without the perspective that the biblical writers claim that they have. And this lack of perspective means that the secularist has three strikes against him on any progressivistic view. On the other hand, people who have grown up in the Western tradition find it extremely difficult to think that history really isn't going anywhere. They find it very difficult to pass into the limbo of the Eastern situation, as I described it at the beginning of the period. They find it very difficult to utilize a cyclical view of history. There are some examples. Spengler provides an example of this, but very few people have followed Spengler. Spengler has been considered really non-Western. What's the matter with him to feel that all civilizations are falling apart? Hasn't he got any sense of finality, progress, goal? Well, Spengler recognized that that from a secularistic standpoint, he couldn't establish any goals. So this gives us a fundamental structure, it seems to me, for the Christian view of history, and if we keep this in mind, it'll provide us with a point of comparison for other views that we're going to talk about. And I want to go on pell-mell now into a very brief statement of Hegel's view of history and then Marx's view of history so that you can see how these are modifications of the kind of view that we've just been talking about. Let's take Hegel. Hegel is certainly the greatest philosopher of history, the greatest classical philosopher of history of modern times. In the 19th century, Hegel's work, The Philosophy of History, became seminal for subsequent work on the subject. In fact, there are experts in this area who say that the very subject of philosophy of history takes its rise from Hegel. People began to think in terms of university courses in philosophy of history, and journals in the field, and books specifically devoted to this in the wake of Hegel's work. What exactly was Hegel's view? Well, Hegel's view, of course, begins with what Hegel considered to be his peculiar logic. And this peculiar logic was a dialectic logic. In my other course, I've talked about this dialectic a bit, and I'll only mention it briefly here. Most of you have had contact with it anyway through courses in the history of ideas. The Hegelian dialectic asserts that an idea spawns its opposite, and the interplay of the two ideas, called thesis and antithesis, produce a synthesis which represents the best elements of both the thesis and the antithesis. That synthesis, that synthetic idea, in turn becomes a new thesis. It gives rise to an opposing idea, and these two, in dynamic interaction, produce still another synthesis, and on the process goes. I used the little rhyme in my other class, bigger bugs have littler bugs upon their backs to bite them, and littler bugs have littler bugs, and so ad infinitum. The dialectic goes moving on in this fashion, thesis and antithesis dynamically interacting to produce synthesis, and so on down the line. Now, for Hegel, the historical process consisted of the interaction of ideas, and this dialectic interaction of ideas would eventually bring about a goal in history, and the goal was the goal of freedom. In order to arrive at this goal, Hegel was convinced that history would move through several world historical ethics. It would do so rationally in terms of this rational dialectic, and the four epochs were these: Oriental, Greek, Roman, and Germanic. Oriental, Greek, Roman, and Germanic. In the ongoing movement of the dialectic, each nation's hour would strike once. This was the crucial hour for the nation, and at that point the nation would, in its action, carry the dialectic process on to its next step. He felt that the Germanic phase was the final phase, and that would issue out into the goal of freedom. And at points where the nation's critical hour strikes, you can't use ordinary standards of morality to judge it. This stands above considerations of morality, and likewise the great men of history who act at these junctures stand above ordinary standards of morality. They are vehicles of the world spirit of reason, and thus they are, in a sense, a series of messiahs that carry history on to its ultimate goal. Well, what about this? One thing very strange strikes us about it at the very outset. It's that fourth Germanic phase. We can perhaps understand the use of the expressions Oriental and Greek and Roman to characterize the major periods of history that have gone before, but why the Germanic? Why the Germanic? Well, that's easy. Hegel was German. And in the middle of the 19th century, Germany seemed, to people like Hegel, to be at the very pinnacle of civilization. Germany, after centuries of decentralization, finally had reached the point of a national state, a powerful national state. At the end of the 19th century, an unheard-of thing happened. Germany, Prussia, was actually able to defeat France. And France had been at the top of the heap politically for lo how many centuries. Germany had suffered from decentralization ever since the famous Golden Bull that established the electoral principle in the Holy Roman Empire. And from there on in, there was no really central, powerful political authority in Germany. Germany had been walked over by almost everybody. And Hegel saw Germany finally coming to the point of world preeminence. Now, we today look back on this and we say, well, sure, Hegel felt that way from his perspective, but his perspective was limited. We see today that Germany does not apparently have that kind of a function. But you see, that's exactly the point. Hegel thought that even though he was within history, caught in the historical drama himself, he could look at the thing, as it were, from outside, and he could see that it was ultimately reaching fruition in the history of Germany. Hegel, in other words, did not recognize that his limited perspective kept him from seeing what the ultimate goal would be. Think of it this way. We'll say that this square represents a graph of history. And here is Hegel with a Germanic grin upon his face, sitting in the mid-19th century. And he is looking back on the expanse of history. He concludes that the dialectic has carried history in a straight line fashion to greater levels of perfection. And he sees this divided into four epochs. Now, even if we were to admit that Hegel was absolutely accurate in this schema, it certainly would not follow that one could necessarily extrapolate along this line to bring history to its finality. Why? Because Hegel didn't know how much history was yet to come. Hegel assumed that there wasn't much to come, and therefore he could readily extrapolate from here, and he could keep this thing going on to the ultimate goal of freedom. But no matter how little history is yet to come, for all Hegel could demonstrate, the thing might go boom into one gigantic historical smash. See? Why would things have to go up toward the goal of freedom? Why not a different kind of operation, ending in unfreedom? You see, Hegel could not establish that even if you grant this, you've got to grant that. Those of you who've had a little statistics know that if you want to extrapolate, if you want to speak about a universe of which you have only limited data, you need to have a representative sample of the whole in order to be able to do this. Statisticians often use the analogy of a pot of stew. If you want to get a representative sample of a pot of stew, what you've got to do is to stir this thing up, and then you put the ladle in and bring it out. Then the ladle will have the same proportion of vegetables to liquid, of solid to liquid, that is in the cauldron of soup itself. If you just skim off stuff from the top, you'll have more liquid than is in the universe that you're dealing with. And if you go down to the bottom, you'll have more solid, see? So it's necessary to stir this up. Now, if you want to make generalizations about history as a whole, clearly you've got to be sure that the proportion of history that you're analyzing is a representative sample of the entirety. But no matter how Hegel grins here at the mid-19th century, he is not in a position to stir up history and pull out a ladleful which will adequately represent what's coming. You see, this is not just a matter of too little effort on Hegel's part. He gets an A for effort. There is a logical problem in what he's trying to do. He has three logical strikes against him at the beginning. Now, if by chance Hegel were up here, outside of the entire human drama, floating about on angelic wings, and he would really have to be more than that, he would have to be responsible for the entire historical drama, then he could perhaps drop a philosophy of history down which would reach Earth and which would provide people with information as to the historical epochs that are actually the case. But unless he's in that kind of position, he's caught in a predicament which is known technically as the human predicament that makes it impossible for him to do this. Now, there is another difficulty with this system. In fact, there are a number of difficulties. I'll only mention a couple here along with this. Hegel assumes that everything operates by dialectic action. It's possible to show that dialectic action is present in certain aspects of life. For example, if I make an extreme statement, such as the United States is always wrong in its political involvements, immediately 12 members of the American Legion will leap up and they will say the U.S. is absolutely right in all of its political involvements. And then as a result of this ridiculous argument back and forth, we will finally probably arrive at the point of saying the U.S. has been right in a number of its political alignments, but wrong in some. We'll get to some kind of a synthesis. In other words, there's a tendency for an extreme statement to produce another extreme statement. That we recognize. But the Hegelian, or the dialectician, in the sense of the term, assumes that everything always operates dialectically. And that is one gigantic assumption. In order to demonstrate it, you would have to check under all the rocks in the universe and make sure that dialectic action was taking place there. That's the only way you could possibly show that everything must operate dialectically. But you see, if you can't show everything must operate dialectically, then of course you can't say that history must come to a particular goal as a result of the dialectic. merely to show that some things operate dialectically doesn't show that enough operates dialectically that you can move along this kind of line. Furthermore, Hegel assumed that the syntheses produced in the historical drama consist of a bettering of what happens prior to them. In other words, when two ideas come into conflict, the best of the two ideas becomes the synthesis. And so the whole business is an onward and upward movement arriving at the goal of freedom. But the fact is that syntheses can provide you with the worst of the two things that enter into them. For example, and I use this illustration in my other course, let's say that you have two very expert criminals. They also have some nice characteristics, but their professions happen to be a criminal. And one of them is a specialist in blowing up safes, and the other one is a specialist in fraud. And they get into a good dialectic discussion as to how to remove the money from a particular bank. And as a result of this discussion, they arrive at the conclusion that there should be a certain amount of fraud and a certain amount of dynamite employed. This is a genuine synthesis. What it provides you with is the essence of the unfortunate positions that go into it. What we're trying to say is that even if you were to say that everything must operate dialectically, it could conceivably be a downward dialectic, which would end up in unfreedom instead of freedom. Hegel, being a good 19th century optimist, and practically everybody in the 19th century was, with a few minor exceptions such as Herman Melville, was convinced that the dialectic had to go onward and upward. But that was a gratuitous assumption. It was not something that Hegel could justify. All right, now let's move to Karl Marx. And this is an appropriate shift because Marx said that he turned Hegel's dialectic on its head.